One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure.
To the heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, his spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walk through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots be on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh.
Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the 29th of May. Very nice to have you joining us this morning. We do have a special edition of the Roundtable on our panel this morning as we focus primarily on the racial unrest in Minneapolis this morning and have a special panel to discuss all of that with. Joining me to host all of us this morning, Dr. Alan Chartok. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. This is a terrible situation that we find ourselves in, and I'm very worried about it because you can better believe that this president, who I consider to be an anathema of the worst kind, will be playing this for all it's worth, but we'll be discussing that this morning.
Absolutely. Well, good to hear your voice, and thank you very much for being here. We welcome your letters, of course, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce the group to you this morning. Clarence Taylor joins us. He is Professor Emeritus of History at Baruch College, CUNY, and author of Fight the Power, African Americans and the Long History of Police Brutality. Professor Taylor, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Wonderful to have you back on the program. C.G. Dodds joins us as well, assistant professor at Albany Law School. Good morning, C.G. How are you?
Good morning, Joe.
Very nice to have you. And Frankie Bailey is here once again, professor in the School of Criminal Justice at UAlbany and acclaimed mystery novelist. Frankie, hello.
Hi, Joe.
Good morning. Thank you very much for being with us. So there were violent protests in both Minneapolis and Louisville, Kentucky last night as tensions over recent police killings escalated. A police precinct in Minneapolis was set on fire. Seven people were shot at a demonstration in Louisville. There were also protests in several other cities, including New York, Denver, and Columbus, Ohio. President Trump posted two angry tweets, one of which Twitter flagged for glorifying violence. The conflicts come after the latest spate of deaths of African Americans caused by the police, including George Floyd, who was apparently suffocated in Minneapolis, and Breonna Taylor, who was killed in March during a no-knock raid of her apartment in Louisville. First, we go to Minneapolis. Protesters broke into the city's third precinct on the city's south side just after 10 p.m., smashed equipment, set off fireworks, and lit fires, according to videos posted from the scene. All police had already fled the building. Firefighters could not respond because of safety concerns. Footage from helicopter cameras showed many nearby businesses engulfed in flames. Governor Tim Walz has sent 500 members of the Minnesota National Guard to the Twin Cities. Meanwhile, in Louisville, seven people were struck by gunfire to protest. The city's mayor, Greg Fisher, said that no officers discharged their weapons and that the violence came from within the crowd. Two of the seven were in surgery last night. In March, Louisville Police fatally shot Taylor, a 26-year-old emergency medical technician, at her home. Questions have continued to mount about the handling of the case. Meanwhile, as Alan mentioned, President Trump, who has long considered racial conflict to be a politically helpful thing for him, sent two tweets about the situation. One taunted the mayor of Minneapolis for not having control of the situation, while the second used the racially charged words thugs in all capital letters and added, when the looting starts, the shooting starts. Twitter said the message violated the company's rules against glorifying violence. The company prevented users from viewing Mr. Trump's message without first reading a brief notice describing the rule violation. That is a brief summary reading from the New York Times. And let me go to our guests and we'll sort of do a round robin of getting people's thoughts on this. Professor Taylor, let us begin with you.
Sure. As I, you know, watch what is taking place, I just said to myself, well, you know, this is going to continue. We are going to have more of these incidents because we are really not getting at the heart of the problem. The police reforms that have been advocated by mayors and others who hold political power don't work because we don't get at the heart of the problem. And the heart of the problem is the overwhelming power that police have over individuals. So this police officer in Minneapolis used his knee and clearly just had his hands. I mean, just horrific scene where he knew he had overwhelming power. And then we find out later that using his knee over someone's neck is essentially an accepted policy by the police. So we have to sort of think about how we police in this country. And by the way, it's not just the killings that people are coming out on the streets. It's the everyday interaction between police officers and citizens, in particular black and brown citizens. And so, you know, like I said, you know, maybe we can talk about diversity training. You can talk about sensitivity training. You can talk about all these, you know, cameras and so forth. They are not going to work unless we really address the what's at the heart of the problem, and that is the overwhelming police power that police have over individuals.
I want to talk much more about that in a moment. Let me continue going around, though, and getting everyone's initial thoughts on this. C.G. Dodds.
I agree that this is an issue of power. But in watching a lot of the coverage and listening to comments and going through my social media feed, I think a lot of what's being missed is what is actually happening when people burn down things, right? When you look at those flames, this is not just a group of out of control people who are burning down things and looting. You are looking at the manifestation of PTSD from hundreds of years of oppression and brutality. You're looking at trauma. You're looking at the epigenetic consequences of racism. You're forced to look inside of a person that is forced to live in a constant state of fight or flight because they don't know when their life is going to be at risk because they have a broken tail light. Someone who lives in a state of perpetual rage. And so we have to address all of those things. But first and foremost, we have to recognize the fact that, yes, these people are burning things down. Yes, they are sick and tired. But these people are also fighting for the soul of America. And some people are just too ignorant to truly understand what is going on right now. For far too long, America has allowed the police to do the dirty work of white supremacy. And so when we see these violent reactions, these are the inevitable consequences of police brutality and oppression. And it will continue. This is not just going to be one isolated incident. This will continue until something is done about police reform, and specifically about qualified immunity.
Frankie Bailey.
Hi, yeah, Joe, I'm trying to think about this. You know, when you call, I said I was just waking up, and I'm still trying to put it all together. But, yeah, I'm split here because, you know, obviously I'm an African-American woman, and I'm also a criminal justice professor, and I'm a historian. And, you know, look at mass media, so I'm trying to pull all that together in terms of what I'm thinking about this. I was just listening to CNN before we came on, and one of the panelists there was talking about the fact that it's been 100 years. It's probably almost exactly 100 years since some three black men were lynched in Minneapolis. And so they were looking back at that and also looking at the other things going on around the country. I think it's a perfect storm at this moment. With all of the things, we've had a really sad, horrible, awful spring, and all African-American people sitting around hearing that our rates of death, infection and death is higher than anyone else in the country at this moment, at least as much as we know. And with all of the other, you know, things involving police and African-Americans, and it seems we never, ever get beyond this moment where we go over and over and over again like a really horrible Groundhog Day. We never really get to some solution. And at that moment when you think, you know, everyone gets it now, then all of the images, you know, captured by the media, and you have to capture those images, they feed into a narrative where people are able to say, well, yeah, this is really bad, but the things that are happening now are worse. And I'm not advocating violence. I'm simply saying that when we try to understand what's happening, I agree with Professor Dobbs about this, that you, in terms of what's happening, we're looking at something that's an accumulation of sadness and anger and fear and rage and all of those things being played out in the same way that they were being played out in the 1960s and before that.
Professor Taylor, you mentioned, I was just struck by what Frankie was saying as far as that we have this Groundhog Day and we keep on going over and over and over again, and we get to this point, and then we start thinking of how we're going to solve the problem. And this is what where we get to what you were saying, that the policies of whether it be cameras, whether it be sensitivity training, whether it be racial training, that is not working. So we have to, and as you said, we have to get to the heart of it, which is the power that these police officers have. How do we do that? How do we do a better job of that?
Well, we do a better job of that by getting rid of policies that give police tremendous power over everyday behavior. So in our the situation in New York City, for example, over the quote violations of lockdown. So you have black and brown people being beaten by the police, while white folks who are also violating the lockdowns are handed masks. That's a decision by the police. How do you stop something like that? How do you get at the heart of that? Well, you know, you have to get rid of policies that will essentially give police that overwhelming power to do so. So, you know, in New York City and other places, they have the policy of broken windows that criminalize so much behavior. And you have a mayor in New York City who backs that. He said, well, I will not walk away from that. Like I said, you have to sort of address those types of policy. And also, you have to enhance the power of citizens in these interactions with police. So citizens should have a greater say in determining punishment of police when they violate the law. That doesn't happen. You know, we set up community boards and so forth, but in the end, it's still the police that make the final decisions when it comes to disciplining police officers and so forth. I think in terms of evaluating police and how they operate in communities, and that's something else that we need to rethink and give people more power and so they can determine and how police operate in their communities. So it's giving people, citizens, greater control of how police are operating in communities. So unless we address those issues, then we're going to constantly keep going around and circles. And, you know, like you said, every time we have one of these incidents, you know, everyone talks about how bad it is and how sad it is, and we have to do something. But they're really not going to do anything unless they get at the heart of the problem.
CG, you said, and I think I'm quoting you correctly, of the police are doing the dirty work of white supremacists. So back to the question that I just asked Clarence, I mean, how do we stop that and make that not the case?
Right. I think that goes back to the last thing that I said in my statement, is that we need to assess qualified immunity. And that is the fact that it is very hard to hold police personally liable for violating the rights of citizens. Qualified immunity is completely judge-made law. And how it has been functioning is almost an absolute shield against liability, where police officers have been able to act with complete impunity and have been able to invoke qualified immunity to cloak them from any sort of legal accountability whatsoever. And that is what we're seeing. Police officers are aware of that immunity, and therefore they exercise this sort of unbridled power over people. Right, to where now they are executing people in the streets. Well, they've been doing it. We just now have it on camera. But we're witnessing state-sanctioned lynchings in the street that are going unpunished because of qualified immunity. And currently, there are a couple of cases before the Supreme Court that are up for Supreme Court review regarding this specific issue, whether or not this has gone too far. We have to address qualified immunity, because until there are consequences, there will be no changes.
CJ, I think that there are some people who are listening right now who would love to have some definition on qualified immunity.
Qualified immunity is a pretty complicated concept, but it's the idea that because the police officers are acting as agents of the state, when they're acting in their ministerial functions, they are cloaked with a certain degree of immunity. It's called color of law is how they are acting. And so it prevents them from being personally sued for certain actions. So for instance, if a police officer is exercising his duties, if he's stopping someone, you can imagine a situation in which you could just sue a police officer for anything. And so qualified immunity is to stop that. The idea behind it is perhaps to stop people from being overly litigious towards police officers. But what happens is police officers take advantage of that doctrine and they do whatever they want. They just completely wield their power in whatever vicious ways that they can think of in that particular time. And they are zero consequences because they invoke qualified immunity.
Frankie, in what CJ was just saying, I thought was interesting, because she also mentioned this, that now it's on tape, and that's so true. You know, we're seeing it. We're seeing it firsthand. Culturally speaking and historically, actually, I just realized we have to take a break. So I'm going to hold that question. We'll take a break and we'll come back. We are discussing the unrest in Minneapolis and about police brutality this morning. We have an incredible panel of experts, Clarence Taylor, Frankie Bailey, C.G. Dodds, Alan Chartok. We'll be back right after this.
Keep on running, 'cause the winner don't quit on themselves.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, basically focusing on what is happening in Minneapolis and the overall issue of police brutality in this country. Alan Chartok is here. Clarence Taylor, Frankie Bailey, and C.G. Dodds making up the panel. We do welcome your letters. We have quite a few. We'll get to them in a few moments. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Yes.
Hey, Joe, I just wanted to make a quick clarification. I think I misspoke. I wanted to compare ministerial duties to discretionary duties. And I just want to make it clear that qualified immunity applies to discretionary duties or matters.
Okay.
So that our listeners are fully informed.
Okay. So what does that mean?
So what it means is that a discretionary function is when you think about police policy. So, for example, the policy about wearing masks.
Yes.
How you choose to enforce that policy of wearing masks is a discretionary function. You have discretion in how you deal with individuals. And so that's where you see the difference in treatment. You know, you have one set of individuals who the police are like, hey, buddy, pal, put on your mask. Another set of people is put on your mask right now. We're arresting people. We're pepper spraying. Right. That is an exercise of discretion. And so police officers have qualified immunity when it comes to that exercise of discretion. And there's an individual has to overcome a very high bar in order to get past that qualified immunity. Now, it's not absolute immunity, but what we've consistently seen in jurisprudence is that it has functioned as absolute immunity. Justice Sotomayor has stated as much in her statements regarding qualified immunity. Justice Clarence Thomas has come out stating that there must be some fundamental changes to qualified immunity. And I do believe that this is one of the key issues that we're going to have to resolve in order to make any sort of a dent in police brutality.
Joe, if I may,
yes.
I would just like to say that as you remember, Joe, I worked as a consultant for the New York City Police Department when I was teaching at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and I talked to a lot of cops, and I think in addition to the legalism here, the real question has been for a long, long time, who becomes a policeman and how you recruit policemen. And whether or not there is a way of doing that so that you don't have a presumption of the American racism, which we see so extraordinarily in everybody else. This is not just a police problem, obviously. They're there because this is a racist country. And so I think one of the big problems is how you recruit police and who they are and who is naturally attracted to this function.
Clarence Taylor, you have long covered African Americans and the history of police brutality in the city of New York. What do you make of that?
Well, yeah, I think that's correct. And one of the proposals I make in my book is that police should live in the communities where they're policing. So-called residency laws. And this is not the case in New York City. So I think if the police have a better understanding of the communities in which they police, then you will not have these horrible incidents. But, you know, it's always been rejected. And the other point I should make is the overwhelming political power of police. And, you know, we can talk about police power, but we also need to talk about the political power that police have. In New York City, for example, the union of the police have been able to force that mayor to sort of back off police reforms. And I think we see this in other cities. So, I mean, unless, you know, I keep going back to this issue of power, unless we are able to address how to reduce the power of police officers, both political power and police power, and enhance the power of citizens, then, you know, we're going to see more and more of this.
Frankie, I was starting to ask you right before the break when we had to go for news, but I'm curious as to, in your study of not only history, but culturally and cultural history, and CJ made reference to this earlier, how have things changed with the sense that these events are caught on tape, are on cameras, and that we can see them? Things that have been going on for generations, but now they are 45 seconds or up to 3 to 5 minutes, and we see what is happening. We often see them from various vantage points and from different angles. How has that changed things, do you think?
I was just about to bring that up, Joe, because when we were on break, I was trying to get another look at what I saw on Yahoo just before we started. Apparently, there's another view of what was happening, another video that I think NBC News has, and they were trying to verify what they were seeing and seemed to have verified that this other view shows the other two other police officers involved in holding Mr. Floyd down. I haven't had a chance to read it completely, but I did notice that around 4,000 people were responding to this video. So that shows you the power of social media to, you know, get people involved in discussion. And I was trying to read their reactions while I was trying to, you know, see what that was. I didn't have a chance to look at it. But I think, you know, in terms of the culture that we're looking at, this whole debate about it goes a long way back. I mean, to Rodney King. I mean, that was the beginning of this, where we're looking at things being caught on camera. But now there are so many citizen journalists, so many citizens with cameras. The police officers are walking around with cameras, and we're getting all of this. And, you know, unless it's something clearly where people can look at it and you would think they would say, yeah, this is true, but with the fake news thing out there, they can look at something and be convinced by someone that this is not true, that you're seeing fake news, that this has been tampered with. I mean, so it's getting more and more difficult to say this is what it is and have people, everyone, agree with you that this is what it is. And that's the dangerous season that we're moving into, the dangerous world that we're moving into, where people are now so engaged in conspiracy theories and so convinced that they can be tricked and so willing to listen to whatever they're listening to, that it becomes more and more difficult to have a conversation. But the other thing I wanted to mention about that, in terms of police officers and African-American men and people of color and how they see this, but particularly African-American men and police officers, we have two groups that are looking at each other across a vast divide. And they're both, even though police officers have power and have guns, they're both feeling a great deal. They're feeling as if they're oppressed. And in some ways, obviously many ways, African-American men are oppressed, we know that. But police officers, the officers who think of themselves as doing their job and doing the best that they can, see themselves as an oppressed minority. And when something like this happens, they, as in the case of many groups that see themselves as oppressed, tend to circle the wagons and see themselves as being made out as bad actors, even when they are not involved in this. And they deny responsibility sometimes for what's going on elsewhere. And you can understand that to the degree that if you're being called bad, that you try to prove you're good. But that doesn't really solve the problem, and we've seen that over and over again.
Alan, I want to just quickly go and ask you about the political implications of this. And as I mentioned, the president took to Twitter early this morning to condemn Minneapolis demonstrators, calling them thugs, threatened military intervention, and suggested it could lead to, quote-unquote, shooting. That prompted Twitter to take the step of limiting the public's ability to view the tweet. How do you think this? We often talk about the president's base, but I'm interested in how that really stokes the literal flames of the fires that are still burning this morning.
Well, first of all, you know, I have made my position pretty clear. This is a racist country. I've talked about for the last several days my six-year-old grandson, an African-American grandson, and what's going to happen when he grows up and whether he wants to go for a jog, and it scares the hell out of me. With all of that said, and I've talked about the police, I know many, many policemen, but the one thing that is really clear to me is that Trump is going to take this and he's going to ride it all the way. Because, you know, when you're talking about middle America, you're talking about watching flames coming out of buildings. You have a brilliant panel on this morning, Joe, and everyone is saying exactly the right stuff. Nevertheless, if you're talking about a country which has elected Donald Trump once, maybe elected him, this is a godsend for him. He is going to be saying, you know, we can't have people burning down buildings and the rest of it. And the purples in this country, to some degree, will believe it. And that will be a tremendous plus for him in this coming election.
Anybody want to comment on that?
Well, yeah,
of course
he's going to take advantage of the situation. When people are looking at Donald Trump's so-called base, we should talk about not just base but coalition. And one important component of that coalition are white supremacists. And Donald Trump is extremely shrewd and mobilizing those folks. So, yeah, I agree that he is going to use this to be reelected.
CG.
I was going to say that even though he referenced the National Guard, to the National Guard, he was speaking to his base, which is primarily comprised of white supremacists who tote guns and show up at the Capitol and threaten violence because they don't want to wear a face mask in the middle of a pandemic. He was talking to those people. He was inciting violence. He wants those people to do something in response to this. And to Alan's point, he's going to ride this all the way out. He has already positioned himself as the law and order president, which from a historical perspective, we know what law and order means. That's in reference to police brutality and the policing of black and brown people. So this is going to become a signature part of his campaign. Do you want to see America burn or do you want law and order? And there's another aspect to this, which is directly related to Russian election meddling, right?
Right.
Because CNN just did this completely tone-deaf report, and I was shocked that they did it. It was so moronic. Where they were talking, and no, it really was, and this was before everything came out with George Floyd, and I was floored because it was so stupid and tone-deaf. But they had gone to West Africa, I can't remember what country it was, to do an investigation on this Russian troll site where the Russian government was using West African people to post articles about police brutality and the strife amongst people of color and the police in America. Now, the reality of the situation is if this situation did not exist, there would be nothing to post, right? But this also speaks to the power or the impact that this has on our foreign policy. Because going back to the idea of what do the videos do, right? If we go back to the 1950s and the 1960s, the power of the videos led to the Civil Rights Act. Yeah, we had an amazing civil rights movement, and I'm not discounting the work of those people at all, but we also have to acknowledge the role that the Cold War played in securing our rights. Because you had the Soviet Union out here advertising to all these other countries of black and brown people saying democracy is a farce. Look, they're beating up black people in America. The same thing is happening again. And so Trump is going to try to use this, but it's also going to appear in election meddling. This problem is not going to go away.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will address some of the letters that we've gotten and discuss this in more detail. We have Clarence Taylor with us, Professor Emeritus of History at Baruch College, CUNY, Assistant Professor at Albany Law School, C.G. Dodds, and Frankie Bailey, Professor in the School of Criminal Justice at UAlbany. Alan Chartok is here, and we will welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Reed.
Say his name.
Jermaine Reed.
Say his name.
Jermaine Reed.
Say his name.
Jermaine Reed.
Say his name.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We are focusing on the racial unrest in Minneapolis, talking about the overall issue of police brutality. Clarence Taylor, Frankie Bailey, C.G. Dodds, and Alan Chartok join us this morning. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel.
Hello.
Yes.
This is Clark. Can I say something before
Absolutely.
We move on to the letters? I think this situation also puts a Democratic Party in a bind. You have a candidate, Joe Biden, who pushed the crime bill. That put more police on the street. You have a party that has moved much more to the center and have essentially supported the growing power of police. And so how do they respond to this situation? And if they're not going to embrace, and I'm sure they are not going to embrace, really policies that are that seem to some people be anti-police, this really benefits Donald Trump.
Alan, I know that's something that you have said. Well, you said it on this show yesterday.
I said it yesterday. I said it this morning. I say it again right now. You know, when people see buildings burning, and the president of the United States says this is chaos and this is going to cost everybody. The people in the middle, the purples, who are what we're talking about, these are the people who will win or lose the election. I think Biden is a moderate. I think the American people are ready for a moderate now based on the kind of nonsense that they've seen. And all along, Trump has been losing in all the polls. We're going to have to see what happens now as this comes out. But it is the moderate middle class that is up for grabs here.
To Professor Taylor's point, what should the Democrats be doing, in your opinion, Alan?
Well, I think they have to be very careful about not saying it is appropriate to burn buildings. We can say, because I'm among them, can say we understand the frustration. We understand what this means to our grandchild. We understand what this is. But if, in fact, the Democrats can be painted into a corner in which it looks like they are supporting the demonstration of burning down buildings, it's not going to be good.
CG?
I'm on the fence. I understand the moderate position on that and the need not to make statements that makes it appear that we support burning down buildings. However, I do think that Trump in particular is misreading the room on this. And I say that because, yes, this is an election issue.
Right.
But if he thinks that this is going to end with the National Guard, he's more insane than I already thought. And if Democrats think that someone is going to be able to issue platitudes and Joe's just going to be able to come out with some statement and this is going to end, they're equally insane. This is a new generation of protesters that we're dealing with. They have no regard for respectability politics, and that's why I absolutely adore them. And so if we think that this is going to be the last burned down precinct that we see, we are in for quite an interesting ride. And this also goes to whether or not he should pick Amy Klobuchar. We've been saying, well, I've been saying, I won't say we because I'm not speaking for anybody else. I could not stand the idea of her being his vice presidential pick. Now, if he does it, he will really be at risk of losing this election because, yeah, we have to get the moderates, but you also have to keep the people who took you to the dance. You dance with the party, with the person who brought you.
Right.
That's right.
And the Democratic Party has to be very careful about seeking out better options.
Clarence?
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. And I think it's sort of a false choice to say that, because you support measures, far-reaching measures, that are really going to curtail police power, that somehow you're alienating moderates. So I think that what you really alienate the people in your base when you are pushing a policy that actually condones this kind of stuff. That says, well, yeah, you know, we shouldn't come out against policies that take away power of police. So I think that that's the big risk for the Democratic Party.
Well, Clarence, I think you're exactly right. I think if you are talking about police, and I've been talking about this for a long time, then you're exactly right. And police reforms. I'm not talking about police reforms. I'm talking about how the president is going to play what we saw last night in Minneapolis. And that's different.
Frankie?
Yeah, I'm thinking about this just in terms of the visuals, and I agree that that's really important right now in terms of the discussion. I think in terms of where I was, getting people to vote, that's one of the issues. But that slogan, the hashtag, vote as if your life depends on it, I mean, to the extent that the Democrats are able to speak to multiple groups about how their life depends on a change in administration, I think they'll be successful or more successful than they might have been otherwise. But I think in terms of the other things going on in the news and the visuals, we have all of those numbers we've been seeing, over 100,000 deaths this spring. And this sends the news off in another direction, and that benefits the president in this discussion that now we're talking about the fires burning and we have the visual images. When we're talking about the epidemic, we don't actually see what this does. We see the names of the people. We see how they look when they were healthy. And we have this, these stories, these heartbreaking stories of people who died. And we put that up against those images of the city on fire and the police department on fire and all of these images that can be incited and, what trumps the other, pardon the expression, in terms of what's those images that people are seeing. And I think to the degree that you can stoke fear based on those images. And the other thing about this, I think it's a really interesting thing, awful but interesting in terms of what's going on. This idea of disease, that when you think of disease and how it's connected to people in terms of criminality, I've been looking at this for the past 4 or 5 years as I think about dress and appearance. And to the extent that you can have this stigma on a group in terms of, or applied to a group, connecting being diseased to being connected to being perceived as criminal. And the idea out there now and the facts out there now in terms of the impact of this epidemic on blacks, that they're dying in greater numbers than other people. And the idea that somehow, I'm sure, a case being made by racists, that they're weaker, they're savages, they're all these other names and things that have been applied to black people. And now they're also savages who are burning down cities again. And so disease, criminality, need for control, and President Trump stepping in and saying, I know how to do this. I need to shut it down.
We have an amazing discussion here going this morning, and we'll continue it. We are going to take a news break. When we come back, we'll welcome your letters. I promise I'll get to the letters. We have a ton of them, and I will get to them. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back after news.
you could say it was a good day. At least a little better than the day in Baltimore. Does anybody hear us pray for Michael Brown or Freddie Gray? Peace is more than the absence of war.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our special program this morning focusing on the racial unrest in Minneapolis and the subject of police brutality. Again, Alan Chartok is here, Clarence Taylor, Frankie Bailey, and CJ Dodds. We do welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. As I mentioned, we have quite a few, so let me get to those now. Marva writes to us and says, good morning, panel. As a black woman, I'm heartened to hear you discussing the race question. The problem is embedded in our culture and can only be addressed by white people who want to change it by continuing to educate themselves about white privilege, discussing, strategizing, and being actively anti-racist. Hopefully, this will transcend not just horror at every filmed murder at the hands of police. There are indignities and inequalities legally targeting black and brown citizens every day that are not filmed. Only white people can dismantle this racist system. Panel, feel free to jump in if there's something that you would like to add or comment on in the letters as we go through them. Tom writes, white woman accuses black man of attack, white woman believed. White woman accuses white man of attack, white man believed. White woman dragged through the coals. White cop publicly kills black man. Trump is silent. Black people strike back at police. Donald Trump is suddenly interested only in America. Richard says, thank you for this excellent show. I don't understand why the police officer who brutally murdered George Floyd for all of us to see and his accomplices in the execution are not sitting in jail right now. I am grateful that the four were fired on the spot. That is good. But those men belong in jail. No wonder there is so much violence and disorder in the wake of this terror. That's a good question. Do we have a good answer? And any panelists can jump in. Do we have a good answer as to why those officers are not being charged at this time?
It relates to the issue of immunity. I wish I could give you a more precise answer, but that is what it's related to. That's why oftentimes, well, the majority of the time, 90% of the time, you don't see officers immediately arrested. Because if this were a normal person, irrespective of the circumstances, if they were on camera murdering someone, they would be arrested and they would work out the details during the indictment or the grand jury.
Does the go ahead.
There's a number of policies that are in place that actually give police the advantage. And I think back to 1999 of the Amadou Diallo case,
right,
where these four undercover police officers who never identified themselves shot this young man, 21 years old, who was just going home. And it took 48 hours before they were even questioned. And that was built into their contract. So this is what police have negotiated. And I said to myself, they have complete control. After they shoot and they kill this person, they have control over the crime scene, a crime that they just committed. So, I think that we have to go back and you have to start looking at some of these policies that are put in place that really protect police which ordinary citizens, as noted, if they commit something like that, they're arrested on the spot.
Frankie, as far as it comes to the history of our criminal justice system, this has long been the way.
Well, you know, I think the other part of this, I'm just thinking about this area and what's been going on there. I think I'm sure that one of the things being considered is also the willingness of a jury to convict if, you know, there's enough evidence, and whether or not, you know, I'm not defending this hesitation to go forward with this, but I'm thinking also that the argument being made is that they need to have all of their, you know, ducks in a row so that they can go to a jury and hope for a conviction. But that is no reason for, you know, it's a very complicated situation, but it's one that they have to be willing to take some action to deal with a situation that's getting worse and worse. And I'm not sure what the appropriate action is now in terms of weighing the case and moving to a grand jury and to court with this, and any benefit to be achieved from waiting. But I was just looking, indeed, NBC is now showing that video and saying the different video now shows three police officers involved in the first takedown and holding him down, and people online at this moment saying, well, you're 10 minutes into this, you know, 1 minute he's sitting there, 9 minutes later he's dead. And then there are other people who are saying, well, if he was able to yell, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe," then obviously he had enough breath and he wasn't dying. Mm. I mean, even people watching this and knowing the man ended up dead are able to come on. And, you know, that could be just your tweets that are being sent out by a robot someplace, but it's agitating the people online who are saying, you know, obviously this man was dying, and then you have these voices popping up and saying he could breathe and you need another narrative about this.
Hard to believe that you can have 200 pounds in your throat and not think that it's going to cause some damage and ultimately death. Marvin writes to us and says, the profound endemic nature of bigotry and racism in our society at every level precedes Trump and will precede him. He is just one more spokesman for this scourge that continues to be an integral part of our society. This nation needs to look in the mirror, every single one of us. We wallow in hypocrisy that often intensifies during economic crisis. That woman in Central Park epitomizes the profound reality of this scourge. I, too, went through a similar experience as that man many years ago in my community upstate. This experience still haunts me after some 25 years. If I didn't get a lawyer then, it would cost me the career that I have today. I would like, on that note and from Marvin's letter, CG, you were talking about the burning and the flames, and that they are symbols for the PTSD and the trauma that many of the people who are taking part are experiencing. Much to what Marvin was talking about, an experience that haunts him 25 years later.
Yeah, I think it is, for Black people at least, that I'll just position it there. Black people have consistently been told to not believe or to not acknowledge or to not affirm how they feel. America has consistently tried to gaslight us into thinking that everything's not as bad as you think it is. But racism is so ingrained in our psyche, in our collective psyche as Americans, that a woman knows that all she has to do is utter those magic words, "An African-American male is threatening my life," and that she could possibly destroy another human being. Now, if you just think about, what does it feel like to walk around in a body knowing that at any moment someone can utter those magic words and you can die? Even if you are innocent. Hmm. That is traumatic. That causes PTSD.
That gets back to what I was saying about the idea of stigma. You're going back to the 19th century after the Civil War, when you have this idea of the new Black criminal, or the new Negro criminal, they were calling him at the time, and this sort of mythical Black man who was a threat to white women, and the idea that in any situation, you know, the word of the white woman, and I'm not, you know, putting down white women by saying this, but this is what the myth was about, that the benefit of the doubt should be given to the white woman, or if we're talking in larger issues here in terms of what was going on, to the white person who made the statement. And the idea that these people are out of control, and that continuing image of people are out of control and dark and dangerous. And if you remember from this conversation, as this woman made her apology, she said, well, you know, in effect, you know, we're in the Rambles, you know, this area, wooded area, and I felt endangered. And so you can have people who are, you know, reading reading this and thinking, well, yeah, I mean, there's an overreaction here. This woman obviously did something wrong, but she was afraid and she, you know, used whatever she had at hand. And in that case, you know, this threat was what she put out there. And now this poor woman has lost her job and she's had her dog taken away and all of those bad things have happened to her. And clearly, you know, if you're sitting there, you think this is an overreaction. She did something wrong, but I might have done something like that in that situation. And they're thinking that, and they're giving her the benefit of the doubt, whereas this man had no benefit of the doubt at all. And people have gone back to look for reasons why they should be have been afraid of this bird watcher who came out of the woods and who was perceived as threatening this woman.
Right. Let me go back to the letters for a moment. And again, you can, we'd love to hear from you. Panel at WAMC.org. Rowan writes, I'm struck by the difference in terminology when describing gatherings. Why was the armed occupation of state houses called protest? An unarmed protest is being called a riot. The violence in Minneapolis was being ignited by the difference in police tactics. For the armed protest, it was hands off. For the unarmed protest, it was tear gas and riot gear. The difference between the two reeks of cowardice and racism. We go to Tom, who says, if your belief is that Colin Kaepernick taking a knee is more outrageous than a cop in Minneapolis, I am afraid this country is in serious trouble. If I recall, Trump had plenty to say about Kaepernick. Not so much now. These people are following their leader. Vicky says, I agree with CG. Qualified immunity give the police too much power and no feet of accountability. A police officer just needs to say, I was afraid for my life, and they are free to murder. Bobby says, the next time you watch the video of the policeman murdering George Floyd, pay attention to the policeman. He bounced while pressed his knee into Mr. Floyd's neck. Look at the posturing of the policeman. His chest is puffed up like a rooster, and he has his hands on his hips, which is another posture of power. Disgusting. The policeman should be charged and convicted for murder, all because Mr. Floyd might have stolen a $20 bill. Outrageous, says Bobby. Carlene writes, the riots are being called George Floyd riots. That's sad because Mr. Floyd did not start them. They should be named after the cop who killed Mr. Floyd. Leonard writes, one additional and very disturbing issue is the rampant epidemic of police violence cannot be separated from the well-documented infiltration of law enforcement communities by openly racist and white supremacist organizations, as reported in the New York Times and the Southern Poverty Law Center. We ignore these developments at our peril. They are open assaults on our constitutional system. Anything on that, Clarence?
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. I mean, these are really powerful letters, and they really indicate people's outrage at what has been going on in this country. So, yeah, you think back, I mean, it just struck me immediately when I saw what was taking place in Wisconsin and in Michigan and in California and other places where these so-called protesters against the lockdowns come up armed to the teeth, screaming at police officers. And then, you know, I think about, then I turn around and look at videos of black people walking the streets and being thrown to the ground and having their knees put onto their necks and crushing them, you know, and it just, you know, gets at the heart of a long history in this country of how dangerous black people are in the imagination of white people. And we clearly need to address that problem. I think the first letter that you read spoke about white privilege. But, you know, this cannot be a voluntary change. We can't wait for people to have an epiphany and say, yeah, you know, what we've been doing has been wrong. The way we've been thinking it is wrong. We have to address policies that's going to sort of change the situation.
We got this letter, and Alan, this is for you. Alan, I've heard you two mornings in a row saying how afraid you are for your African-American grandson. You are right to be. I share those fears. My grandson is mixed race and looks African-American. He has faced what you fear numerous times, most of them with little to no reason. Nothing will take away bigotry and racism. We can only hope that we raise our loved ones to know how to try to deal with it and hope and pray that they do not become the ultimate victims. Blessings on your grandson. May he grow to be a fine man, making you proud, as mine has.
Indeed. Indeed. What else can I say?
We go to Joe, who says, I'm sick of the leftist media pushing the narrative that all cops are racist and the whole country is racist. I'm also sick of hearing that the people looting and setting the city on fire are protesters. They are thugs and they are riots, not protests. I do believe some are trying to peacefully protest, but the majority are burning that city down. Protesting violence with more violence is not the answer. CG?
I guess he doesn't believe in America. I say that because America loves violence. America was built on violence. The Revolutionary War, the Tea Party, stealing tea and throwing it into water. That is violence. America responds to violence with violence. Would he have this same sentiment when it came to 9/11? Did he not want to go to war when that happened? And so talking about you shouldn't be using violent tactics. Black people are consistently told not to be violent, irrespective of the fact that we are treated with vicious violence on a daily basis. We want to talk about looting. How do you think the majority of Western museums came about? Looting and violence. So miss me. I'm sorry, I'm on air, so I can't say what I really want to say. But miss me with the
damn
nonsense.
I wish we weren't. Go ahead.
No one's perpetuating a narrative that all of America is racist. No one's doing that. Anyone who saw the protests saw that there were people of all colors, people of all backgrounds who were involved in those protests. And there are images of people acting as allies and protecting the Black protesters. So no one is saying that. That being said, I'm not going to lie to myself about this. I'm not going to lie to myself about the fact that America, the fabric of America, the genetic code, the genetic makeup of America is racist, period and point blank. And if you don't like it, maybe you don't like the truth. If you don't like violence, you don't like America. If you don't want to deal with violence, if you don't want to see violence, if you don't want to see buildings burning, then you need to hold the police accountable for murdering people in the streets.
Wow. Go ahead, Clarence.
You know, right on with that. You know, you want to stop those scenes where you see buildings burning and stop killing Black people. You have to, once again, deal with that situation of power. But let me note here, with that writer really pushed on, was this whole, what I call the false narrative. And that is the idea that if you don't address, if you address policing by trying to curtail the power, what you're doing is essentially handcuffing the police and allowing people to, violent criminals to run rampant. And this has been used by politicians, has been used by law enforcement, you know, the unions of law enforcement for decades in order to make sure that police hold on to their power. And so, you know, for me, that letter is essentially, it's really a nonsense. You know, we cannot essentially take our eye off the prize here and really get sort of addressing, well, like I said, what's at the heart of this problem, and that is that overwhelming power of police to do whatever they feel like doing in communities and get away, getting in Black and brown communities and getting away with it.
Vincent, right? Go ahead.
Yeah, if I can just say something about this historically, I mean, in terms of what we're looking at, whenever, and this is something, you know, social scientists look at in terms of this kind of explosive activity going on, and I'm not characterizing it in one way or another right now, because obviously in terms of your standpoint, it's either a riot or a rebellion. But when you have a situation like this, from what we know about how this type of action occurs, it's usually reflecting some underlying, ongoing tension between the police and the people involved. Are the people involved in a group that they're rioting or rebelling against. And there's this triggering incident like this where you have a long history of tension, of your activities happening, like arrests that people are concerned about. And then there's this moment when this man dies and you have all of the rumors and all of the other things building up, and this explosive moment when a window's broken, the first fire set, and then it goes on from there. And you have a lot of different people out there at that moment. There are some people who are taking advantage of what's going on, but clearly there are other people who are protesters. And all of these people are caught up in what's going on, and people sitting at home and watching are not making a distinction between the people who came there for peaceful protests and the people who are there for criminal activities. And they're looking at this, and they're putting all these people together. And this is not, you know, there have been other people who riot. Black people are not the only people who go into the street and engage in a riot, as this person's calling it, or a rebellion. There have been other people who do this. If we think about the draft riots in 1863 in New York City, I mean, we're looking at Irish Americans and others out there at that point. So this is not a unique thing that African Americans do when anything happens. It reflects something that's going on, an underlying and continuing tension between groups.
Let's go back to the letters. We just have about 2 minutes before we go to a break, and I want to get as many as I can in. Vincent writes, I believe even if you do hire quote-unquote good cops after a while policing, most of your interactions with the community are negative ones. It is just natural to form an us-against-them mentality. This is particularly true for police working in minority communities who have absolutely no affiliation with that community. Hence, the blue line of silence and internal racism. I've seen it firsthand, white cops working in the inner city and driving home to their beautiful suburban neighborhoods. The problem is not the individual officer. The problem is systemic. I would like to get back to that, actually, after the break. Clarence, maybe we can talk a little bit about that, of what we do about that problem of getting more police officers from the regions that they are, from the areas that they are policing. Let's go to Vincent's letter, who says, as I'm listening to this discussion and about racism and Donald Trump and his role in its escalation, I watched a video being circulated of white men dressed in all black wearing masks, and one even with an umbrella block his identity, smashing windows of his store with a hammer and piling up wood around shopping carts to start fires. The black protesters did try to stop him. It makes me wonder how much of the ensuing violence is perpetrated by Trump's base. The negative press coverage against police of color during an already chaotic time is exactly what Trump is pushing his people to be involved in. Adam writes, Nick writes, we can't talk about police brutality without talking about white supremacy and privilege, signed a white man. And Stephen says, the killer of George Floyd has a history of violent altercation with African Americans. This is a common characteristic of cops who kill in the so-called line of duty. I'm going to stop there. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have our final round with our panelists. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org.
Of my true love's hair. his face, so soft and wondrous fair. The purest eyes and the strongest hands. I love the ground stairs. Black is the color of my true love's hair.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our discussion this morning. We have a wonderful panel assembled. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Clarence Taylor is Professor Emeritus of History at Baruch College, CUNY, and author of Fight the Power, African Americans and the Long History of Police Brutality. C.G. Dodds is with us, Assistant Professor at Albany Law School. And Frankie Bailey, a professor in the School of Criminal Justice at UAlbany and an acclaimed mystery novelist. We do welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We just have about another 12 or 13 minutes, and we will get to as many as we can in that short time. Clarence, I did mention before the break, I would like to talk to you just a little bit, and everyone can join in on this, obviously, but this idea of neighborhood policing, and we've heard, had a couple letters on this very topic. How do we improve that? How do we do better? Are there programs out there that are working?
Well, I think they have, you may have some programs, like in New York City, where you're right, they don't call it community policing, they now call it neighborhood policing. I think there have been some improvements, I guess, in the relationship between the police and the community. But I'm critical of those types of programs, neighborhood policing and what they call community policing, because it really doesn't address the issue of power, and sometimes I'm even puzzled of what they mean by community policing or neighborhood policing. Does it mean that you want better cooperation between law enforcement and the community? Well, I mean, the only way that I see that actually taking place is to give communities greater say on how police operate in their communities. Unless you're willing to address that, then, we're going to continue with this problem. One of the things I did recommend is to have residency laws, have police live in those communities. And you can do that easily. You just through city councils or through state initiatives, make it a requirement. But the problem is that police unions have fought that. And because of their immense power, they have been able to avoid those residency requirements. So, I can go on with a whole list of initiatives that one can take. I think clearly what's at the bottom line here is that we are going nowhere with this. We're going to see this continue unless we really start addressing how rethinking of policing in this nation.
CG?
I agree with the residency law requirements. I think it's something that the police unions have fought for a reason. It would be something that would be easily implemented. I know when I was an assistant attorney general in D.C., there were residency requirements for people who worked in the attorney general's office in certain supervisory positions. And there were also incentives for staying in a place, so helping people buy homes, those sorts of things. And I do think that that would go a long ways towards, I guess, neighborhood community policing, which I hate those terms too, because I think the reality of the situation is people need to be viewed as people. There shouldn't be a special title assigned to it. Just be a
No, we lost CG.
Oh,
there
back.
You go. Go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead. I know it's easy to mute yourself when you're doing that on the app.
But it just broke up. But, you know, I completely agree with the residency law requirements.
We got a letter about you, CG. Do you want to hear it? It's the subject is kick-ass panelist. I'm so glad to finally hear someone who is completely fearless about saying the truth. Your young panelist who speaks about the African-American experience perspective is brilliant. I've been hearing about these ideas from my 30-something daughter for a few years, and I'm glad to finally hear it on WAMC. Your panelists can educate more white liberals to seeing things from a raw and true perspective and wake us all up. So thank you.
Thanks. I thought it was hate mail.
No. No. I wouldn't read it that directly if it was.
Well, this is the morning to do that for me. I'm in a mood.
Olaf writes and says, I gotta reread that one before I read it out loud. And let's see. Patrick says, we white people need to support African-Americans, period. We need to follow their lead to make change. Anything else is evidence of our latent racism and fear of losing our personal white privilege. Frankie, yes, I wanted to get to you on the idea of neighborhood policing. Anything on that and when it comes historically of what that means and what it could mean for the future?
Well, I think historically it means that the people in the community know the police officers who are assigned to that community and the officers know them. That doesn't guarantee that the police are going to react in a way that's sensitive to the people in the community. But knowing, because historically, I mean, we've had bad officers assigned to communities. So that's no guarantee. I mean, legendarily bad officers who are violent and who acted in unjust ways. But I think the whole, this comes down to power, to the perception. I mean, you give people the power to be at the table. That shouldn't be something that we're talking about. I mean, people should be at the table as a right, where the police are inviting people to the table and they're discussing this in a way that one group doesn't hold power, although obviously they do in terms of their ability to act, but that they don't have whole power in terms of making decisions. Because the problem, you can have an administration in the police department and they're all into inviting people to the table and having discussions about the issues and trying to deal with them. And then once they're gone, you have the re-entrenchment of all of the old ways of doing things. And we've seen that, you know, in this area where, you know, one administration goes out and another comes in and it's sort of a revolving door. And just as people are beginning to hope something's going to change and that, you know, we'll find solutions and find people sitting down at the table together to talk about things and reach solutions, then something happens and the administration, the chief tires or is reassigned or something else happens and we're right back where we were before. So we need to find some way of getting, and also I think a discussion about implicit bias is something that we need to have, where the officers don't feel defensive, where we're talking together about what it means to be human and respond in various ways to people and getting training in that, where we're talking about how this plays out in real time.
Alan, anything you'd like to add to the conversation as we start to wrap
up? No, I did want to go very quickly back to one of our commentators did a very interesting aside about Mayor de Blasio.
Yep.
Mayor de Blasio comes in as a progressive. He's married to a progressive woman who happens to be African-American and who is making and he goes after the police right from the beginning. And then there is hell to pay and he backs off.
That was Clarence.
Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. De Blasio did run as a police reformer. He was going to stop cop question and frisk, a clearly racist policy. He talked about not hiring more police officers. And the police union, the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, turned on the mayor and used what I call is the sort of false narrative that he is going to tie the hands of the police and therefore let the criminals run wild. And after two police officers were killed by a deranged man, the head of that union made the claim that de Blasio had blood on his hands. And when at the funeral of those police those two police officers, you saw this horrific scene where cops turned their backs on the mayor as he appeared. And the mayor then saw his ratings going down among white New Yorkers, and then he sort of reversed course. He wound up hiring more officers, something like 1,300 more officers, and giving more money to the police. And so it was pretty clear. Even the police commissioner then, Bratton, said, you know, this is like one of the best budgets I've ever had. And ever since then, de Blasio has defended the actions of the police. And I listen to him on a regular basis. Even in this case where we talk about the discrimination in terms of how they enforce their policy of people who violate the lockdowns. He says, oh, it's just a small number and so forth. And the police are always doing a good job and so on and so forth. So, yeah, what happened was that they used their power and he clearly backed away.
Amazing. That's amazing. And what's really amazing about it is that, you know, progressive, blue, Manhattan and the Bronx and the rest of it, New York City, progressive, side with the police in this case, don't you think?
Yeah, and nationally, Alan, I mean, wasn't stop and frisk one of the main reasons that the candidacy of Mike Bloomberg that was expected to change the entire face of the Democratic race fizzled?
Yeah, I mean, clearly that was the case because Mike Bloomberg came out at the very last minute, right?
Right.
He decided to announce that he was going to run for mayor, and he apologized. Well, what was he doing before then all those years? He was essentially going around defending stop, question, and frisk. Even when a federal court ruled that it was racial profiling. So, yeah, I mean, and by the way, I should note here that New York City has not given up the policy of stop, question, and frisk. They have not given that up. They still have that policy. They have reduced the number of people who dramatically reduced the number of people who are stop, question, and frisk, but it still goes on, as does broken windows, which is even a more horrific policy.
Mm-hmm. I am wondering... I'm asking on the air, which is not very professional, but I have to do it because I have no other way to communicate with you all. But if we have an option of going another 10 minutes, is there anyone with us who can't stay with us for another 10 minutes?
No, I'm fine.
All right.
I'm sorry if you can hear my cat online. He's standing by the telephone. I can't get him to go away.
No, that's okay. We welcome pets. That's fine. We're from home. It adds to the allure. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I'd like to end. And let me pose this question. I'll give you some time to think about it. I know it's, you know, typically we'll try to find something positive to come out of this. So the question that I would like to have you all address is, what we can do to channel how we are feeling, whether that is anger, whether that is rage, whether that is disgust, whether that is sadness, concern, how do we channel that and perhaps, as CG said at the beginning of our conversation, prevent this Groundhog Day mentality? So I'll leave you with that question. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll finish up right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our discussion. We're going into extra innings here. Alan Chartok, Clarence Taylor, C.G. Dodds, and Frankie Bailey. Right before the break, I just asked everybody to think about this question of what we can do to channel whatever it is that we're feeling. And I realize that's different in each one of us. And of doing something positive, something constructive, so that, as I said, that we avoid, maybe not tomorrow, but over some time, these incidents from happening again. CG, let me begin with you. Maybe I lost CG. All right. Let's see. Alan, are you there? Okay, Clarence, let's begin with you.
Yeah, sure. I'll jump in there. I think that this is an opportunity for folks to think about, that larger issue I've been talking about. How do we police in this country? And, I think that what can come out of this is that people are motivated, first of all, think about that, but also get involved in organizations and that are on the ground that are attempting to bring about real police reform. And there are a number of organizations and communities throughout this country that are doing this. Yeah, it's important to go to the polls and vote elect progressive candidates, progressive district attorneys that are going to sort of address mass incarceration and policing and so forth. That's one way of doing it. You know, we can push for legislation. It's another way of doing this. There are organizations out there that are doing this. And as I noted in my book, that we have had a long history of people battling police assaults and police brutality. We can go back and look at that history and learn how certain organizations address this, because we have had some successes, right, in courts and so forth. So I think we can take this opportunity not just to get angry about it, but really take, really measured, important steps.
Frankie Bailey.
I'm a Southerner by birth, and so I have a great appreciation for images and narratives and that whole discussion around race. And I think we all have to come from where we are. And so where I can come from on this is looking at talking to people about those narratives, about how we perceive this and why we perceive it, according to social scientists. And I don't just talk to people in schools. We have this community engagement. I don't really like that term because it sounds like we are not a part of the community. But one of the things, for example, we have coming up, a local library and the League of Women Voters. We've been talking about a series of discussions around James Baldwin's America. And James Baldwin, of course, was writing about many of these issues back in the 1960s and looking at police departments and looking at how they were perceived. So I think putting this in context and moving from that point in terms of bringing people to the table and letting people come at this from their differing points of view and trying to reach some consensus about what it is we believe and how we should build from there. That's what I can do around this, and I think there are so many ways of approaching it.
C.G. Dodds.
Uh-oh.
Are you there? Not there. She was there. And
Joe?
There you go. Hi.
There I am.
Okay, go ahead.
I don't know what's going on.
That's all right. We're almost done. That's all
maybe
right.
Maybe it's my mom telling me to shut up.
I doubt that.
I think the thing that we all can do is be honest with ourselves about what we want to do, right? I think in order to avoid the Groundhog's Day effect, we have to say, okay, well, what do I want to do, and to actually do it? It's very easy for us to talk about it, to do it in a very academic setting, to be on the radio. But what does it mean to be actually on the ground and engaged? And if you aren't a person who wants to be engaged on the ground, what does it look like for you? What can you do? What particular skill sets do you bring to the situation that you feel like can help resolve the situation? And I think that's what we have to do going forward to avoid this Groundhog's Day effect where you feel like every day you're waking up to the same thing.
There was a quote that Frankie mentioned a moment ago, James Baldwin. There's a quote going around on social media about 30 years ago that James Baldwin was the subject of an American Masters documentary. And he reflected on the so-called progress of racism in the U.S. And he said, what is it that you wanted me to reconcile myself to? I was born here more than 60 years ago. I'm not going to live another 60 years. You always told me that it's going to take time. It's taken my father's time, my mother's time, my uncle's time, my brother's and my sister's time, my niece's and my nephew's time. How much time do you want for your progress? A pretty good question to leave everybody with this morning of how much time do you want for your progress? Alan, your thoughts?
Well, look, I've been pretty plain on this. We do live in a racist country. There's no question that the amount of skin pigment somebody has makes a big difference on almost everything that they face or don't face as a result of that. And we have to deal with racism, and we have to call it out when we see it. I'm desperately afraid of how Trump, who I think was losing this election, really losing it, polls were all there, is going to play this and is going to get people in the middle with him. And nothing is worth that as far as I'm concerned, because he is the ultimate racist scourge that we have in this country right now. So I'm quite concerned about what's happening.
CG, how do we change that as far as that? For what Democrats need to do of ultimately what Joe Biden needs to do over the next few days and weeks?
You know, I agree with Alan. I think that, of course, Trump is going to use it. Joe Biden has to decide, and Democrats have to decide where they stand on this. You cannot straddle the fence on an issue like this. And so I understand that there's a call to be careful because it's, you're faced with, do we get Trump out of office?
Yeah.
Or do, you know, we speak truth to power and be completely honest about what we feel about this? And Joe Biden is, I think he's a moderate at heart. So I don't think he has those very, what some people will call far left views. I call just human views. I really don't know what to do about that, because either you believe in justice or you don't.
Well,
and if you're...
Well, let me
just about a minute left, but go ahead,
okay,
Alan.
Very quickly, but it's one thing to say the guy, the cop with his knee in the man's neck, murdering him, that was terrible, and I think Joe Biden is capable of that. The thing that he has to worry about is the way Trump is going to be playing the violence in Minneapolis, for example.
Right, but there's nothing he can do about that.
That's right, but
you get what I'm saying.
I do, and I do think he's going to be for whatever reason, I think he's going to be able to say, look, what led to that is terrible. But I think he has to be careful.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I think he has to be careful, because no matter what, you've seen people perpetuating this narrative of, oh, they're violent, they have no right to be looting, destruction of property, all of those things.
Sure.
Joe has to be very careful, because you don't want to alienate the person who brought you to the dance. At the same time, you're still trying to be in the middle. And this is an issue where it's going to be very difficult to straddle the fence. I wouldn't appreciate him straddling the fence.
It was
also that first responders issue, because right now, and rightfully, people are honoring first responders and police officers at this moment, you know, in terms of how people perceive them. I think they're just reluctant to believe that police officers can do really bad things, some of them, when they probably know police officers who are doing good things. So to the extent that they are always on the front lines, there's always going to be that difficulty in terms of Biden and how he can talk about them.
I'd like to thank...
And can I just point... Oh, sorry.
We're out of time. I'm so sorry. We're out of time.
Okay.
And I went
okay.
extra innings and everything, but oh well. Clarence Taylor is Professor Emeritus of History at Baruch College CUNY, author of Fight the Power. Clarence Taylor, thank you so much for being with us. Great pleasure.
Well, yeah, thank you, and I want to thank the rest of the panelists. I learned a lot.
Thank you. C.G. Dodds, Assistant Professor at Albany Law School. You'll be with us next week. Thank you for being here. And Frankie
thank
Bailey, and all these people I woke up early to have on the show. So thank you very much, Frankie. Thank you for being on the program. Alan,
thank
as always, have a beautiful weekend. Thank you.
You too, Joe.
All right. We'll be back on Monday. We'll be back with more show after this.